Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Monday, February 23rd, and start with an announcement. We're going to be carrying over House Bill 2395 to Wednesday, hopefully first item of business on Wednesday. We haven't got the language we need. They're still working out tweaks. We have this wonderful compromise that everybody agrees to. We want to make sure that's what actually gets into the bill. So House Bill 2395 will be first order of business on Wednesday. I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Diabetes Report and invite some folks. Who's going to be the panel? Scott Broom and Kristen Aird. That's it. We're really happy to see Representative Broom back with us. He's been a diabetes champion in this committee for some time now. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Good to see you.
Hey.
Go ahead. Okay, great. How about do you want to start? Or let me just start?
Sure. I'll start hand it over to you.
Okay, fantastic.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. I'm Kirsten Aird. I'm the Chronic Disease Programs Manager with the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. There we go. So today I'm here to share with you.
We're going to decide whether it's going up or down.
Yeah, look at that.
It's going down.
So today I'm here to share with you information about diabetes and reaffirm what many of us know, that it is definitely a problem. The number of people is increasing, and it is costly. To address this problem, Oregon developed a strategic plan in 2009 to slow the rate of diabetes. And as required by Senate Bill 169 from last session, the Public Health Division has prepared a report including the burden of diabetes and progress made on the 2009 strategic plan. Diabetes has more than doubled since 1990 in the last 25 years. Over 287,000 Oregon adults have diabetes. That's 9% of the population. And 7,000 additional adults are diagnosed each year. It's important to note that over 1 million Oregon adults are diagnosed with prediabetes. The data is clear. In order to address diabetes in Oregon, we must also address obesity. Similar to diabetes, adult obesity in Oregon has increased over the last 25 years by 121%. People who are obese are at much higher risk of getting diabetes compared to those at a healthy weight. And in Oregon, among those with diabetes, half of them are obese. Obesity is largely caused by poor nutrition and lack of physical activity. Today, 27% of Oregon adults are obese, and 70% are overweight and obese. And 10% of our 11th graders are obese. Unfortunately, diabetes affects some communities more than others. While I mentioned 9% of the adult population has diabetes, 12% of the population with less than a high school education have diabetes, compared to only 5% among college graduates. 19% of Oregon Health Plan members have diabetes, compared with only 7% with employer-provided insurance. And among racial and ethnic minority groups, nearly one quarter of African Americans have diabetes, 15% of Latinos, 14% of American Indians and Alaska Natives, compared to just 7% of non-Hispanic whites. Diabetes is an economic burden. According to the American Diabetes Association, nearly $2.2 billion in excess medical expenditures are associated with diabetes each year, averaging $7,800 per person with diabetes. Additionally, costs due to lost productivity estimate $840 million a year, totaling $3 billion annually spent on diabetes in Oregon. If diabetes is not properly managed or controlled, severe complications such as infections and nerve damage and kidney damage can develop and lead to hospitalization. In Oregon, hospitalizations last year for diabetes were at $44 million, with an average of $10,000 per hospitalization. As I mentioned earlier, in 2009, we developed a strategic plan, and recently we've reported on the progress of that plan. So to share with you some highlights, not much has changed. We have lots to do, but we know where we're going. To reverse the trends of diabetes and obesity, Oregon needs a comprehensive state and community-wide approach. The highest priority in 2009 remains the highest priority today, to establish and fund a comprehensive obesity prevention and education program to support population-wide interventions that will reduce obesity, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. We are in this together, and in order to achieve the triple aim of better health, better care, and lower costs, we have a plan to follow and have that in front of us. A couple examples of what has happened lately. PEB and OHEB have decided to include the National Diabetes Prevention Program and Living Well with Chronic Conditions as covered benefits, evidence-based benefits for public employees and educators and their dependents. The Oregon Metrics Scoring and Health Committee for the CCOs has included blood sugar control among people with diabetes as one of the 17 incentive metrics. And OHA has expanded cross-agency collaboration with the Department of Education and the Department of Transportation to work towards increasing access to healthy foods and more physical activities and walkable communities. However, much remains to be done. And again, the priority from 2009 remains that in the Senate Bill 169 report, and that is to establish and fund a comprehensive obesity prevention program. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information, and I will take any questions from the committee.
Yes, Representative Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had heard somewhere that either the Oregon rates of obesity or overweightness for children, it's either Oregon or nationally, have started for the first time to come down. Is that correct?
There, I know what you're speaking to, and we can get you the exact numbers. One of the things we've been talking a lot about is leveling off.
Mm-hmm. So that's it. It hasn't actually gone down, but it's leveling off?
It's hard to say it's a trend. Uh-huh. You need a couple data points, okay. A few years to get there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate these efforts, and obviously they've been going on for a few years already, but do we have kind of a projection if we're able to accomplish these, at which point at least we're going to go back to the leveling off, but at least start falling? I mean, I see the legislation 2020, so is that, will it be that long? Because the trend, even since 2009, continues to be up, and so I'm wondering what the prognosis is for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have done a lot of great work in leveraging very limited resources. And we know through looking at our tobacco prevention and education program that when investments are made in comprehensive programs to prevent disease, particularly around issues like tobacco or physical activity and nutrition, that we can make a difference. And that is what the evidence speaks to from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
But tobacco is so much simpler than diabetes prevention.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big addiction problem, but it's very straightforward. This is a
quite, yeah.
You done? I have a couple questions.
I just wanted to understand. So as part of the issue remains, and I think we know a lot about it, we know about obesity and that, but the issue remains resources, whether they be human or otherwise, in order to carry out.
Yes. Yes.
I wish that were the only problem. I mean, I'm not convinced we really know what to do. which is a different problem. Senator Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Scott, good to see you here.
Thank you.
It's funny, when I started in the legislature, I knew of a couple representatives that had diabetes. Scott was one of them, and my own son, when he was 16, came down with type 1 diabetes. So, and then I have a stepdad who's type 2 diabetic, and then a father-in-law who's diabetic as well. I just see a lot of things happening on the front for type 1, and I'm just wondering, one of the things that we see, we actually had it for other diseases, but lack of knowledge in our school systems and stuff for this. I mean, my son, they said, well, if you need a shot, you need to come up to the office. They didn't understand, hey, when your blood sugar is low, it needs to happen now, or if you're really high, it needs to happen now. And just the education for people amongst people dealing with diabetics and everything, I was just kind of surprised because the lack of knowledge I had, and was like, God, it's no big deal and everything. And, you know, if I would have saw you having chills and sweats, I would have thought, okay, he's acting weird, and moved on before not recognizing it. And I think education is something that we really need to look at for our type 1, especially our young children that are coming down with diabetes.
In my comments, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I want to address something very briefly called Safe at Schools, which addresses a lot of what you're talking about with your son at school.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions, and I guess we can put it in the parking lot if there are going to be other comments on it. You mentioned the terrible disparity in people of color, but I mean, you don't talk about any special programs for dealing with that, and that seems to me a very high priority. If it's 7% in white population and 25% in the black population, it seems to me that points you in a particular direction. Do you have special programs for minority populations? And I guess the question, I've studied diabetes over the years, for many years. You actually have a solution to dealing with the obesity epidemic? I mean, we can do CCO. That's an extraordinarily difficult health behavior issue, and I wonder if you have. Here's the answer. It would be really nice to hear that.
Well, I certainly have ideas, and there have been a number of really excellent folks, Chair Greenlick, who have also been thinking about this. And one of the things that the report does speak to, while obesity is certainly complicated because it involves nutrition and physical activity, energy in, energy out.
And society.
And absolutely. Some of the commonalities it does have with tobacco prevention is really needing a solid infrastructure. There's been lots of conversations about education and the importance of that. And what does that look like deployed throughout our very different communities in the state? And how do you have an infrastructure prepared in each county to look to that and enhance and further and provide that convening entity, which is what we've done a lot around tobacco prevention? We also know that large campaigns, media campaigns similar to tobacco prevention, when you can warn people of the dangers of sugary beverages or other very high calorie, high, you know, not nutritious food, how do you let people know about that in a very big way, because we're talking about a population approach. And then certainly you had talked about programs that are specifically designed for specific populations and are also grounded in evidence so that they become reliable to be paid for and resourced by employers. And we have some of those as well in the National Diabetes Prevention Program, which we've been working with the African American Coalition to deploy, and Stanford's Chronic Disease Prevention Program.
One last question to put on the table. In my experience, the major problem with diabetes isn't diabetes. It's the fact that it's a very likely contributor to heart disease and cancer. It would seem to me a lot of the issues around the treatment of people with diabetes relates to the whole question of smoking, blood pressure, cholesterol, the typical heart disease and prevention stuff. Is there a lot of that in the work you're doing in terms of helping?
It's very leveraged. We actually have a chronic disease prevention program under the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention section, and we try to look at people understanding that they have multiple diseases. They often don't just have one. And so how do we look at that more holistically?
Thank you. Who's next?
She and I will go next. I'll lead this. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Committee, it's just great to be back. Good to see some friends, and just great to be here. I was here. It's been 4 years, but it doesn't seem like that long ago. And I want to thank all of you, first of all, starting with you, Mr. Chair, for the great work that you do on behalf of Oregonians and for the great work that this committee has done and continues to do for those in this state with diabetes, almost 300,000, as we heard earlier, and their families. So thank you for the good work that you do. I'm here today as a former legislator. I'm here today with a bunch of people, including my daughter, show the T-shirt, that are wearing these red T-shirts today. This is the Diabetes Advocacy Day at the Capitol through the American Diabetes Association, so I also represent them. I'm here as someone that has had diabetes for 33 years, but mostly I'm here as the father of somebody who was diagnosed a little over 2 years ago with type 1 diabetes, my daughter, Katie. If you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair, I would just like to give a little quick layman's primer on diabetes, just so everybody kind of has an understanding of what we're talking about, because the world has kind of changed a little bit. Back in the olden days, there were two types of diabetes. There was, creatively, it was called type 1 and type 2. Type 1 was referred to as juvenile onset diabetes. Usually that occurred with people that were kids. You'd get it when you're 5, 6 years old. By the time you were a teenager, you were kind of on the outside curve, if you will, of getting type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes has always been called adult onset diabetes, and hence the name. People would get that usually in their middle age when they were adults, sometimes related to lifestyle issues. Over the last 20 years or so, Mr. Chair, that world has kind of, the differences in that world have kind of shrunk. They've kind of morphed together. You find more and more young adults, 20s, 30s, even 40s, that are acquiring type 1 diabetes from some environmental factors that we're not sure of. At the same time, where adult onset was always adults 20, 30 years ago, now we find children acquiring type 2 diabetes. These are, again, a lot of issues with lifestyle, or at least, if not exactly type 2 diabetes, they have all the markers for pre-diabetes when it comes to type 2 diabetes. So when we talk about the world of diabetes, I just think it's important to know that the world has changed a little bit, and it's become, frankly, more severe. Great statistics earlier, just to put it all in context of what we're talking about. We have almost 300,000 Oregonians with diabetes, and we have another 1.1 million people in Oregon with pre-diabetes. Nationwide, just to put it all in perspective, we have about 25 million people and growing with diabetes. The public cost of diabetes in Oregon is staggering, as was already mentioned. We spend about $2.2 billion in medical costs alone. Then they say another $800 million a year in just the lost time, lost wages, lost productivity. I personally believe it's much higher than that. Nationally, the cost is almost $300 billion when you talk about just diabetes. Forget about the issues with productivity and everything else. And the costs, both here in Oregon and nationally, have grown over 40% in the last 5 years. Think about that, 40% in the last 5 years. When I was on the committee, Mr. Chair, I know we used to talk about this. We used to talk about certainly there were kindness issues to wanting to manage the issue of diabetes, the things we are required to do from a health perspective. But I also remember when I was sitting up there, Mr. Chair, that we would talk about the fiduciary responsibility as policymakers to manage diabetes. Forget about the personal implications. Forget about the health implications. I believe you cannot do your fiduciary responsibility as people, as a body that's looking out for the best interests of taxpayers, without addressing the cost and the issue of diabetes. It is the most expensive problem, if you will, chronic health care problem in the Oregon Health Plan and every component of health care in Oregon. And if we don't address that in the short term, we're going to keep paying the bigger dollars in the long term. What does that mean? What are those things that we have to do? What do policymakers have to do? Well, we have to make sure that we have the essentials for managing diabetes. We've got insulin. We've got medicines. We've got blood glucose monitoring. Diet, exercise, activity, education, training, even proper dental care is an important part of managing diabetes and managing the escalating costs of diabetes. So that's why we're here today.
In 2007, as was mentioned, and with follow-up legislation, we passed a bill, Mr. Chair, that said, you know, State of Oregon, you need to get your arms around and control the growth of diabetes, not only the human damage that caused, but the cost that creates. And this resulted in a mandated strategic plan. Toward this, much has been done, but of course, much still needs to be done. So today, diabetes advocates and the American Diabetes Association are respectfully requesting that the legislature do the following this biennium: implement the strategic plan, fund obesity prevention, diabetes education, school fitness programs, and programs for healthy foods, including the Farm Direct Nutrition Program. Further, help ensure that Medicaid and all state insurance plans provide adequate coverage for the basics: insulin, pumps, test strips. If you've heard the story about test strips and how an insurance company will allocate one or two test strips a day for type 1 or type 2, you know what a joke that is. There is no way on God's green earth that you can manage diabetes by only checking your blood sugar once or twice or even three times a day. Both Katie and I do it 8 to 10 times a day, and even then, we could, and our fingers are raw to show for that, even then, we could probably do more if we wanted to have the best kind of real-time management that we can. Then finally, I want to say, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, to your point, I think this legislature needs to pass a school nurse program, at least a comprehensive program via task force, and there's specific legislation in this committee. I'm sure you'll see House Bill 2185. There's a program that the American Diabetes Association puts on called Safe for Schools, and it is designed to work in conjunction with school health officials, if you will, especially nurses' staff. Katie has had a lot of positive interaction with this, and basically it's simply this. It's the American Diabetes Association coming in, working with school staff, working with principals, working with counselors, working with teachers, working with the school nurse, hopefully, to talk about what's today's reality when managing diabetes, because you wouldn't be surprised to learn that so much of what schools think they know is decades old and just doesn't match the current drugs and the current delivery mechanisms that especially kids today have. So with that, Mr. Chair, that was a lot of words in a short period of time, but very much appreciate you having us today and would certainly welcome any questions.
Katie, do you have some comments for us?
Why don't you tell them how you're doing with everything?
So I've had diabetes for about 2.5 years. I was diagnosed.
Please start with your name, Katie.
Oh, my name's Katie Bruin. And I was diagnosed about 2.5 years ago when I was 10 and going into my fifth grade year at a new school. And I had a lot of support through my dad, and because he has diabetes, and I have a lot of other family members who have type 1 diabetes, and so that's really helped. But it's hard for other people, and it's hard for me as well sometimes.
Does the environment in the school make it easier for you to deal with your control, or is it a barrier to you?
I come from a really good school district with a really good school nurse, and at my primary school, they even had Safe at School come in, and it's all been really good, but there's some other, like, school districts that aren't as lucky as mine is.
Thank you. You must be very proud.
I couldn't be more proud.
Any questions in this panel? Yes, sir.
I guess, follow up, I know I've spoke with Representative Kenny Geyer about this a little bit, but the Oregon Trail Card that we issue, a very, very high percentage actually is type 2 diabetic. And one of the things I think that we could look at, and I don't know if the Diabetes Foundation has looked at this, but how we handle WIC, where we say these are the types of foods that you could buy and stuff. I wonder if that's something that we shouldn't be looking at taking up as a legislature on limiting carbs. I mean, I cut carbs out of my diet because in this building it's easy to put on weight and dropped 18 pounds just by limiting the amount of carb intake that I have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, it's a great point and a great part of the legislation that the task force has advocated for. Certainly, that entities like the ADA and the JDRF advocate for are just that. It's a question of education. Can I just tell one quick little story? So, Katie and I and her mom with the American Diabetes Association, we were at the ADA's expo at the Portland Convention Center back in November, and we were sitting. Katie and I were sitting at kind of this advocacy booth. booth, and lots of people milling around. It's a big trade show almost. You know, people selling the foods and whatnot that help people manage diabetes. Gentleman came up. His name was Charles, and he was a big man. He was probably 6'4", and he was a very proud man. He had a retired U.S. Navy cap on, and he liked to talk. And so I ended up talking with him for about a half hour. Turns out he had been serving in the Navy back in the 1980s. And while he was serving in the Navy, he acquired type 2 diabetes, and his weight grew and grew and grew to the point where he was, you know, if I recall the conversation correctly, he was well over 300 pounds, and again, probably close to death's door. He, through some intervention from the Navy, frankly, from his friends and family, after he had been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and had, frankly, even let it slide after that, had a little, if you will, come to Jesus kind of reality with the education, with how to manage. To make a very long story short, this was back in the late 80s. Here I met this man, you know, 4 months ago, 3 months ago in November of 2014. He was slim. He was fit. He was an advocate for all good things as far as management and diet and everything else. He would tell you every kind of he would educate you on every kind of story and every kind of food to eat, carbohydrate, everything, blood sugar management. He told me that his A1Cs were below 6, which for those that may not know, that basically means he didn't have diabetes anymore, as at least from that perspective. He carried a little glucometer with him that we all carry, and I said, how often do you have to test your sugar? He goes, I don't have to do it anymore, but I still take it with me just to remind me that I can't slip off the path. So, Mr. Chair, Representative, my point to raising that story is that's a story, but it boils down to the education about how to live, how to eat, how to manage your life, how to take responsibility in your life for the food that you put in your body and the things you do with your body to remain active. That's how we solve, at least for the most part, type 2 diabetes, and that's how we get our arms around the cost, the explosive cost of diabetes in the state of Oregon.
Guys, thank you very much. Oops, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I was just going to comment that a lot of the studies I've seen also point to toxics in the environment, stress, the effect that stress has, poverty indicators that really drive up obesity. So I think that it's really important, besides looking at the behavioral things that we can promote, to also look at food deserts. How do we do WIC senior farm direct programs like that that bring fresh fruits and vegetables to low-income populations? And then how do we deal with some of the stress, cortisol that triggers? I know the whole epigenetics now of the organs of health and disease talk about turning on certain genes that increase the proclivity toward obesity and diabetes. So I look forward to working with my colleagues on some of those. Really, that's why the roadmap is so difficult. There's so many different pieces. There's no one answer. But it's amazing to me that the number is 3 billion, because I remember the tobacco number being 2 billion. And so now it's surpassing that. It's astounding. So thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, for coming.
Thank you.
Katie, are you going to follow your dad into politics?
Oh, gosh.
Sounds like you
She's
have a
lot
great,
smarter
you
than
have
me.
A great Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to close the informational hearing on diabetes. My intention is to, it's going to a work session on 28-28 for the purpose of moving the bill to the Ways and Means Committee. It has a fiscal that you may have seen of $600,000, which if it stays on the bill, will clearly make it difficult for Ways and Means to pass it, but it can be clear and various things can be done. So I will open a work session on House Bill 2828. And do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we send House Bill 2828 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Notes moves that we send House Bill 2828 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, that it be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Oh, do we have to put that on?
Yes.
Do we need a separate motion for that?
No.
Motion does it.
This motion does it, and okay. we have prior authorization from the Speaker's office to add it.
All right. That we send it to Ways and Means by our own action. Is there any discussion on this?
the bill to pass.
Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Glenn?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noth?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
On to Ways and Means.
Was that an aye?
That's an aye.
It's a quick gavel.
And the bill goes to Ways and Means via Candales. I am closing the work session on House Bill 2828 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2307. And Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2307 prohibits mental and social health providers from providing any service to an individual under 18 years of age for the purposes of attempting to change the individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. This declares it has an emergency clause effective on passage. We have some pre-requested panels, Mr. Chair.
Could you please call the first panel?
Yes. Jenna Frazzini, Jason Zenobia, Arthur Safir. I need to go tell the press since we're running ahead of time.
When you testify, please begin by introducing yourself.
Be happy to. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Gina Frazzini, and I serve as the Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon. And I'm pleased to bring forward House Bill 2307, the Youth Mental Health Protection Act, on behalf of our tens of thousands of constituents all over the state. Basic Rights Oregon, as many of you know, works to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians experience equality. And we believe that this legislation is a clear and tangible step to ensuring our state is one that prioritizes the safety and affirmation of our youth, particularly our LGBTQ youth. As the organizational sponsor of this bill, we strongly urge your support for House Bill 2307. This will ensure that licensed professional health care providers do not subject Oregon youth to harmful conversion therapy. This conversion therapy includes a range of dangerous and discredited practices aimed at changing a person's sexual orientation or suppressing a person's gender identity or expression. I want to thank each and every member of this committee for meeting with us in the past week about this bill or talking with us and asking such thoughtful questions. We've worked hard to address your questions, and you'll hear answers to them today from a broad set of experts and individuals impacted by conversion therapy. We believe that every LGBT child is born perfect, and that any young person's identity as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender should be honored, celebrated, and supported. Conversion therapy practices are based on the false claim that being LGBT is a mental illness that can and should be cured. And every leading health and mental health professional association in this country has rejected that view, and they have deemed conversion therapy treatments as ineffective, harmful, and dangerous. But unfortunately, our current Oregon law does not protect young people or their families from being coerced and subjected to these harmful practices, and that puts our young people at risk for depression, for decreased self-esteem, for substance abuse, and suicide. Some people have wondered if the bill's needed and if the practice persists in this day and age. I've heard a lot. And there are so many stories from members of our community who've been harmed by this therapy, stories that date back years, maybe even decades, and those that are fresh and maybe just a few weeks or months old. So we're here to ensure that their voices are heard and that these practices are put to an end. We're here for folks like Lori Warren from Gold Hill, Oregon, in Jackson County. She shared her story in a letter to you, but was unable to be here today. Lori placed her trust in a licensed counselor who claimed that he could help her to become straight. And after 2 years and the expenditure of about 10% of her income, her monthly income as a teacher, she was left humiliated with therapy that had caused her both great emotional strain and trauma, which she struggles to come back from even today. Lori's story and so many others are really heart-wrenching, and they are preventable. Another question that has been raised is whether or not this legislation may have any unintended consequences. This is an important question and one that we take very seriously. The legislation has been carefully drafted to clearly and narrowly define these dangerous and discredited practices. Conversion therapy does not include therapies that provide support or acceptance of LGBT identities, therapy that facilitates social support or identity exploration, or therapy that addresses unlawful conduct or unsafe sexual practices. And to this end of ensuring we have the clearest possible language, we will be offering an amendment. The language is in process. We'll also be following up on a few questions that we have received. In particular, I wanted to provide that assurance to Representatives Kenemer and Representative Hayden that we have a few things to address around questions that you've raised as well. Ultimately, Oregon youth and families have a right to expect that a therapist practicing under a license from our state will not put them at risk of severe harm, including depression, substance abuse, and suicide. And considering that suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth between the ages of 10 and 24 years of age, and the fact that lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth are four times more likely to attempt suicide as their straight peers, we must do everything we possibly can as a state to prevent the loss of even one child. Passing House Bill 2307 is a major step in that direction. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm very pleased to turn the mic over to Jason Zenobia.
Committee, as we go along, and you have a question, just raise that question rather than trying to sort them out. So if you have a question on the witnesses as we go along, please ask. Let's go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, excuse me. Chair Greenlick and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jason Zenobia, and I strongly support House Bill 2307, the Youth Mental Health Protection Act. When I was 16 years old, living in Lake Oswego, my parents sent me into conversion therapy. I was gay. I couldn't imagine any future for myself. For all I knew, my options were prison, or life in a mental hospital, or death by violence or AIDS. I was suicidal. My parents were worried for my safety, and they wanted to find help. The professional therapist they turned to claimed that he could cure gay people and make them straight as long as they were properly motivated. This was the only hope I could imagine, to make it go away. But you can't fix something that's not broken. I turned even deeper inward, into my own shame and fear. I turned away from my parents, my friends, my brother, everyone who mattered to me. This therapist encouraged me to lie to myself and everyone else, so I did. After a year or so, I just wanted it to stop. I planned my suicide, but I did not go through with it. I told the therapist I was cured, and he accepted that. Before we parted ways, he brought my parents into one last therapy session where he scolded me for all of the pain I had caused my mother and father and instructed me to apologize to them for what I had put them through. It took me years to unravel the damage that this treatment inflicted on my relationship with my family. The scars are still there. Sometimes I feel angry about it, but something my father told me years later helped. He said, "You always want your children's lives to be easy. We thought we were helping you. We just didn't realize how much damage we were doing. If we had it to do over again, we never would have done that to you." Too often, we read in the news about families who never get that second chance. This is why I urge this committee to vote in support of House Bill 2307, so we protect future generations of families from enduring this kind of pain. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm pleased to be your chairman, Greenlick, and the rest of this board. You've done a lot of good work for health in this state.
Thank you.
You especially, Representative Greenlick, and the rest of you folks, too, and I'm just really pleased to be able to testify to you. I'm Arthur Saffer. I'm Jason's father. And I did terrible damage to Jason and our family. And I've come here today in order to ask you to help prevent this terrible experience befalling other citizens of this state. In 1987, When Jason was at Lake Oswego High School, he completely surprised me when he told me he was gay. I wanted the best for Jason, and I was concerned with how this would, his being gay, affect him in life. Up to that point, most of my awareness of being gay came from off-color jokes. What little I knew or thought I knew made me very concerned. I was concerned that Jason would be rejected by society, unable to find happiness, and worse yet, unable to find the love that I share with my wife. Clearly, I was woefully ignorant, and I had to do something about that first. My professional life is biomedical research and development. I have two doctorates, in fact. My career was built around years of experience solving technical problems. I did what I knew best how to do. I reviewed the medical and scientific literature to learn about what Jason's condition and what could be done about that, or what should be done about that. But I made one terrible mistake. I've come here to ask you to help protect others from making that same mistake that I made. The literature at that time, we're talking about 87, supported the idea of sexual orientation was changeable by clinical intervention. There were articles that said that. Now, they were misleading, but I know from my technical experience when I read these articles that there are two things missing. Psychological trials were not controlled, which means that it's totally subject to the bias of the investigator. And secondly, there was no follow-through to see what happens 20 years later if these people are still converted or whether or what. But that was the best that I could find, and I acted on that very, very poor information, very badly supported. We arranged for Jason to see a psychologist at Lutheran Family Services in Portland. The psychologist quickly concluded that Jason was a gay man and should learn to live a happy and fulfilling life as a gay person. He was right, but I was still so steeped in misinformation that I did not accept his conclusion. Next, I contacted the psychologist receiving the most funding from the state of Oregon. I guess that was your committee who supported him. And he was supported for treating people convicted of sexually deviant crimes, figuring that he could refer me to somebody who could help. He did. He referred me to a well-respected colleague who had a lot of experience with clinical intervention for young gay people. After a number of treatments, Jason convinced him that he was cured. The matter was dropped. When Jason was a college freshman at University of Puget Sound, he told us, in fact, that he was gay. By this time, I had learned that being gay did not mean Jason would be rejected by many people. He could find happiness in the world, and he could find the kind of love that I had, my wife and I had. We never went back to that psychologist who no doubt was convinced his practice was valid and continued to bring grief to more families. After all, he talked to Jason, treated him. Jason said he was cured. That's the last he's going to see of it. There's no follow-through. This is very convincing evidence to any clinical practitioner that he's done the right thing. Now, 25 years later, Jason has found great happiness. He's attained profound love with our very wonderful son-in-law, Brent. And I come to ask you to help others to avoid this terrible mistake. Please. Protect every family in Oregon. Please ban the practices of conversion therapy in Oregon by voting in support of HB 2307 so that we can protect future generations from this cruel practice and the suffering that I've had in my son and my family.
To make clear, that bill doesn't outlaw.
Beg your pardon?
To make clear, that bill doesn't outlaw the practice. It simply prevents it from being applied to anybody younger than 18.
yes, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, are there any questions? Thank you very much for your story. Very brave to be here. Appreciate that. Can you call the next panel, please?
Samantha Ames, Alyssa Ciampi, Brad Larson Sanchez. Alyssa, I'm going to spell it C-H-I-A-M-P-I.
Again, please state your name when you begin your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Samantha Ames. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to submit this testimony in support of House Bill 2307. I am a staff attorney at the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the coordinator of our Born Perfect campaign to end conversion therapy. NCLR is a national nonprofit legal organization dedicated to protecting and advancing the civil rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and their families. Our youth project was founded in 1993 specifically to address the mistreatment of LGBT youth in the mental health system. In my work with a network of conversion therapy survivors, I have seen firsthand the devastating impact on parents and families and children when they are misled by state licensed professionals who give them false information that therapy can change their child's sexual orientation or gender identity. And tragically, not all those children survive. That being LGBT is not a disorder is no longer a subject of debate within the mainstream medical community. In 2009, the American Psychological Association reviewed all of the existing peer-reviewed data on conversion therapy and concluded that there is no credible scientific evidence that such efforts are effective and significant evidence that they are harmful, especially for children, and linked to dramatically increased rates of depression, substance abuse, unsafe sexual behavior, isolation, and, as we are all too aware, suicide. Because these practices have no scientific basis, provide no medical benefits, and carry such high risks, every single one of the nation's leading medical and mental health associations have issued policy statements condemning them. Just a few weeks ago, a New Jersey court concluded that, quote, any expert opinion based on the initial premise that homosexuality is a mental disorder or abnormal is unreliable and barred. That court went on to rule that professional claims that being LGBT is a curable mental disorder constitute consumer fraud. Even the United Nations Committee Against Torture has pressured the United States to address the recent resurgence in conversion therapy. Myself and other NCLR attorneys have helped defend laws exactly like this one before two circuit courts now, both of which have concluded that these regulations are entirely constitutional. This bill will not affect the ability of minors to seek any type of medically sound therapeutic treatment. It is as unremarkable as every other law that regulates a licensed professional, myself included. It will only ensure that state-licensed mental health providers cannot subject minor patients to dangerous, ineffective, and discredited practices, and cannot defraud loving parents who would never knowingly place their children at risk of such serious harms and who count on the law to ensure that state-licensed professionals treat their kids safely, ethically, and responsibly. Working closely with these survivors, like the ones in the room today, I know all too well that the bill before you right now is a matter of life and death. The recent suicide of Leela Alcorn, a transgender teenage girl forced into conversion therapy, has been a wake-up call to much of the country that we need to act now to protect our children from an industry that frankly profits from their pain. HB 2307 would protect the most vulnerable among us from being told that who they are is wrong, and would protect families from the agony of discovering too late that their love for their children has been preyed upon by a trusted professional. I strongly urge you to support HB 2307 and send a message to all Oregon children that they are safe to be who they are in the state they call home. Thank you.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Alyssa Champy, and I'm a second-year student at Western Oregon University. There I'm studying public policy and administration with a concentration in state and federal government. And I think that it's so vital for you all to pass House Bill 2307, and here's why. So I was raised in a family that was very conservative and Christian, and our only views growing up were that LGBTQ people were weird, wrong, gross, different. Anything that wasn't good was what they were. And so as you can imagine, that made it nearly impossible for me to come out about my sexuality. It wasn't until I went to college that it was easier for me to figure out things about myself. One of the biggest goals that I set for myself, a personal goal, was to figure out just exactly who I was. And I did. I was able to figure out my sexuality. And through the realization of that identity, I started coming out to people on campus. I am openly known as LGBTQ on my campus, and as well as my closest friends. So after a few months of that, I decided to come out to my sister, who then outed me to my mom. And that was one of the hardest things that I've ever dealt with. And my mom instantly brought up a conversation about conversion therapy. And I figured out this wager with my mom, whereas if I agreed to go to just one appointment meeting with a licensed professional therapist, that she would then either back off completely if I didn't like it, but if I did like it, great, then she would pay for it and she would open the door for me to be able to keep going. And so I went to one. Obviously, I mean, I didn't like it. I wasn't a fan of it. That hour that I met with a therapist was the hardest hour of my entire life. As if I was stepping back in my coming out process a little bit. I was experiencing feelings of guilt that I had already moved past, feelings that I was wrong or weird for being who I was. As soon as I left the appointment, I felt as if I was robbed of not just my dignity, but also of my sense of self and the security that I had there. But looking back, I do consider myself to be fortunate in the sense that it was only that one therapy session. It wasn't multiple, as I know that other LGBTQ youth and people have a different outcome, a worse outcome than what I had. And that makes me think of people that I know from my hometown in Medford, Oregon, where these are students in high school who battle with the same anxiety and depression that I did. And they're closeted. They're afraid to come out to their parents. They're terrified because coming out to them means that they could have the same outcome as I did, that their parents will force this life-damaging and horrible therapy on them. And I know that if I would have came out sooner while I was still in high school living with my mom, that I would still be in therapy today. And all for loving the people that I love, and that is not fair. And that alone is why I support this bill, and I urge you to support passing House Bill 2307. Thank you for your time, and I'm open and excited to ask any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Sir?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2307. My name is Dr. Brad Larson Sanchez. I'm a psychologist and member of the Oregon Psychological Association. I'm also chair of the Diversity Committee of OPA, and I'm here to represent OPA in support of the legislation to prohibit licensed mental health care professionals from using conversion therapy with minors. When Basic Rights Oregon approached OPA asking for support of the proposed legislation, the Diversity Committee, the Legislative Committee, and the Executive Board on the whole were supportive of the legislation. We requested feedback from our members, and the overwhelming response was supportive as well. One concern that was raised was relating to setting a precedent for legislating what psychologists can and cannot do in the room in a therapy setting. Nonetheless, we feel that this concern is important to note, but completely outweighed by the need to support this bill to eliminate dangerous and discredited practices. Decades of research in psychology affirm that same-sex attraction is a normal and positive variation of human sexual orientation. Homosexuality is not a mental disorder, and it's not a disorder at all. Leading scholars studying trans health conceptualize much of the distress experienced by trans people through processes of minority stress, not an inherent pathology. There's also a body of literature that cites that the improvement of mental health after receiving appropriate medical support and treatment for transition. So regarding conversion therapy, most major medical and mental health professional associations do not support the use of so-called reparative therapy or conversion therapy for gay and lesbian and transgender individuals. The ethics code for psychologists is consistent with the charge of the Oregon Health Authority. We're required to provide effective, evidence-based treatments that are scientifically informed. In addition, we are required to not actively harm individuals with the treatments that we provide. The research on reparative therapies is abysmal and shows that not only are these methods ineffective, they are harmful. Just a couple of weeks ago, as already mentioned, New Jersey declared judicially that reparative therapy is the equivalent of consumer fraud. So the OPA, along with the nation's leading professional medical, health, and mental health organizations, does not support efforts to change young people's sexual orientation or gender identity and have raised serious concerns about the potential harm from such efforts. So passing this legislation will reinforce the ethical imperative for psychologists as well as other mental health professionals. Additionally, this legislation will serve to educate and empower the consuming public, especially our youth, to reject the fraudulent practice and damaging practice of conversion therapy. By passing this legislation, you're serving to help protect young people who are often unable to advocate for themselves. The OPA is in full support of this bill and strongly encourages its passage. Thank you very much, and welcome any questions.
I have a question. Okay. Chair Greenlick, thank you. And I've presented several questions to my co-chair, and I believe the sponsor of this bill. And one of the questions that I have, it talks in some of the literature that you've provided us, the American Psychiatric Association talks about doing no harm, which we certainly agree with. And it said part of the reason that they support this is that alternatives aren't available. And being a national organization, I'm wondering if they have considered in Oregon we have the availability for parents to make a decision for their children to stop the development of their puberty if they feel like that this child may not be developing as they wish. This minor can, or these parents can go to their physician or psychiatrist and get medication to stop that development. I've asked why that practice isn't included in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the question. We actually only just heard about this concern recently, and I know that there are advocates in this room who would love to address it later. I do just want to briefly say that I work on these bills in a number of states, and that in every one of them, we've enjoyed strong support from mental health and health organizations, and we expect Oregon to be just as strong. The evidence tells us that the best practices for LGBT children, for trans children, and indeed for all children, is acceptance and support. And so we are working with the mental health and medical communities to ensure that there are no unintended consequences of this.
I'm not sure that got to where you were going. You want to follow up?
So my question is a little more pointed. Why aren't we addressing the fact that parents can have their minor children prescribe medication to stop puberty?
I absolutely hear your question. This bill has nothing to do with puberty blockers. I can tell you that. And if there are concerns about the drafting that could in any way implicate that, I would point you to Oregon law, which defines sexual orientation and gender identity very narrowly.
I think he was asking why we aren't.
Yeah, why aren't we including that?
Why aren't we including that?
We are the only state, is that right, that allows it?
No, I'll speak gingerly here. I'm not sure if I've got it covered. But, I think because that kind of intervention is supportive of a young person and not trying to prevent their transition, that would be in alignment with the way that they perceive themselves. So we would want to support that practice and not limit it.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a form of acceptance and support, which is evidence-based best practices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to thank you for clarifying, you support the puberty blockers, but you don't support the psychological aspect that might be considered in making those decisions, which means that they can't get informed consent or they can't talk to their psychologist about doing the puberty blockers, but they can do the medication, but their psychologist can't engage with that. Over here, you're saying, no, you can't talk about it, but you can give the medication. Aren't we leaving an informed consent bridge uncovered?
I think that the difference, the critical difference here is the difference between sex and gender identity. Puberty blockers do nothing to change gender identity, which is really the issue of this bill. They encourage kids who tell us as young as 3 years old exactly who they are to be accepted and supported with the help of licensed professionals and doctors in the state.
Okay.
Just to add to that, I just want to say this bill does not prohibit people from working with a licensed mental health professional to talk about the process of choosing puberty blockers. That's not prohibited by this bill.
Sir, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back. Flu was an ugly week, and I'm still ravaged a bit by it. Dr. Sanchez, I want to follow up with you. And for purposes of disclosure, I am a retired psychologist, so no longer practicing. But I was intrigued by your testimony about OPA stance. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what is the stance of the Board of Psychologist Examiners regarding conversion therapy?
I don't want to speak for the Oregon Board,
uh-huh.
But I know that they are also in support of the spirit of this bill.
How do you know that?
Having spoken with a member of the board.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to suggest that we might want to hear from the three licensing boards that are addressed in this bill. My suspicion is, based on the original clinical evidence going back to the 80s, that it's probably already taken care of as a sanction by these boards. But I don't know that for a fact. And I just... not sure that this isn't redundant, and it does, and it raises some other questions that I have too, about what constitutes discussion about gender and gender change. You know, I remember as a psychologist, I had a lot of people come in to talk to me about an assortment of things. Often, I had no idea why they were coming, and often did not anticipate some of the questions and comments they had. And I just think. While I'm very supportive, and I think we need to be very careful that we're not coercive, and I think from what I know of the evidence, and my experience is outdated now because I no longer do my CE, but I think the evidence was that conversion therapy is not an appropriate and an effective treatment modality, and therefore unethical and would not be expected to be used by those who are licensed by the state of Oregon, I would think. But we need to confirm that.
He's a psychologist in recovery.
Well, someday.
We're going to come back for a work session, and more along the line, perhaps we could ask the boards to join us at the work session, see what they think about it. That'd be fine. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had some questions about this when it first came up, and I had legislative counsel actually draft and give answers for some of the questions that I had on the issue, and I know we do have Mark here because I had concerns on what the effects are with our judicial side and some things like that.
All right. Well, why don't we excuse this panel if you're done?
Mr. Chair, if I could yep. another comment. It's unclear to me as I read the bill whether, for example, licensed school counselors who are licensed through the teacher program rather than through mental health, school psychologists and school counselors, whether they're covered by this bill.
I think Representative Widener would like Mr. Mayor to join us, and I see him in the back, so why don't we excuse this panel and ask Council Mayor to join us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Mark, maybe the simple question first. Does this include school counselors and school psychologists?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, yes, it does.
Pete's name.
Excuse me? Oh.
Your name?
My name, for the record, Mark Mayer from Legislative Council. Apologies. If you look at, I believe it's on the second page of the bill, lines 3 to 5, mental health care or social health professional includes any individual not described in this paragraph who's licensed in this state and whose license authorizes the individual to provide mental health care or social health counseling services. That was originally added in order to get at psychiatry through the medical board, because that is not a designation made by statute. It is purely a creature of rule. And there are other mental health and social health professionals that have licenses or authorizations to operate
according to rule that aren't specifically designated by statute. So it should affect any licensed person who has as the purpose of the license to provide these types of services.
President Widener, do you have some questions, Mr. Mayor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I've actually been fortunate because I kind of got to go over some of these with Mr. Mayor in my office. I guess one would be in Section 1, 2A, basically page 1, lines 9 through 12. Does the term provision of a of services limited to the application of this bill just work within the licensed professional occupation, or does it apply to all actions on or off the job? And does it matter whether the work is paid or unpaid? So this would be somebody who might belong to a different organization or whatever, and they provide services for free for that organization. Let's just say I'm a professional counselor, I attend a church, go to that church, and then I'm providing services or working as a youth minister or something like that, and this would come up in a religious event where I would talk to him. Would I be subject to this since I'm a licensed professional?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, the answer to that question is yes. The bill would affect a person in that situation. I would draw your attention to the use of the word provide services, and we don't have a strict definition for that in this bill. So a court, absent a definition in a bill, they're going to look first at the text and the context of the particular wording of the statute if it were to become a law. And I went ahead and I pulled the dictionary definition of services so I could read that to you. Services means employment as a servant, work performed by one that serves good, contributor to the welfare of others, or useful labor that does not produce a tangible commodity. So there is a component of having to actually provide work or labor for a specific purpose here, but it is not, it does not hinge on whether or not they receive compensation or on whether or not they provide the services within their professional capacity. So you mentioned a church. I think the important thing to remember here is the bill does not prohibit a church from offering these services, but if you're a member of a church who holds a license, you cannot participate in that program or activity. You can speak about your opinions to these things, and you can participate in activities that don't relate directly to the provision of services, but you would not be able to participate directly in the activity if it's offered through the church or other program. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes.
Okay.
And then follow up to that. The next one.
You know, one of the things we need to be cautious about is I think we're okay with time, but a lot of people have come to testify. We could move some of this in when we have the work session, but let's keep going for a bit. And I know Representative Hayden has a question as well.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Some of the language, like we just heard, seems broad. In order to avoid any unintended consequences, would this affect any of the programs or anything that's going on the judicial side? We talked about this in my office.
That would be, Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, we did discuss programs, or you brought up that point, that there are programs that are being run through the Judicial Department, and that would be something I would have to research further. I'm not exactly sure of the impacts. I'm not completely aware of the makeup of those programs, so I'd have to go back and research that.
Okay. So Hayden, and then Representative Kenneman.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. You mentioned that a licensed professional in a church or a nonprofit situation that wasn't being paid would still fall under the application of this law, I believe. And so my question to you on that, have we looked at any violation of the constitutional rights of free speech or exercise of religion for saying, okay, you're a licensed therapist, you're not at work, you're not being paid, you're within your youth organization, and you speak to some of the things that apply under this law if they were doing it in their practice. Is there a free speech or a religious concern there?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, there are protections underneath the Oregon Constitution that are stronger than those underneath the United States Constitution for free expression, and that, those fall underneath Section 1, Article 8. I won't go through the entire test at this time, but part of the test is if what is targeted in a statute or a law is a forbidden effect and not the speech itself, the court is going to look at it's going to honor that, and they're not going to find it to be unconstitutional so long as the bill is no broader than is necessary to prohibit the forbidden effect. And here I think that it's prohibiting the provision of services, not speech in and of itself. And so as long as the activity involved is the provision of work or labor as defined, it's going to be found to be constitutional. If a board attempted to suspend or revoke a person for simply speaking their mind about one of these things, that act by the board would probably be found to be unconstitutional as applied. It would not affect this if it were to become law, but the court would look at the application of the law and say the board overstepped its bounds in that particular instance.
Wouldn't you be, if you were providing dental services free in a religious setting, still be bound by the rules of of the dental board? I mean, I think this is similar to that circumstance, I think. Anyway.
So I have a follow-up question. Can I?
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Chair. So under Section 12A, where it talks about this a little bit, it includes attempts to change behaviors or expression of self. Can you expand a little bit on what that might mean in a setting with a licensed professional outside of, like, in there? You said it has to be of a narrow scope. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at that from a narrow scope, how does that fit within a narrow scope?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, the language attempting to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity, from a legal standpoint, the most important word there is attempting, which creates a mens rea component, and attempt is usually something that has to be done intentionally. So the person would have to be intentionally engaging in activity, work or labor, to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity underneath the bill. As to the other aspects of the language, I'm not an expert on conversion therapy itself, but there is a mens rea component there that's important to legal to understand it legally.
I was actually, can I follow up? I was actually referring to line 3, where it says including attempts to change behaviors or expression of self. So the third line of that seems.
Line 11 of the bill.
Oh, thank
line
you.
Line 11. Seems to broaden line 10.
From a legal standpoint, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, from a legal standpoint, again, I think the important word is attempts. It does, including usually means from a legal standpoint that the legislature sending a clear signal to the courts that this is an inclusive prohibition as opposed to exclusive, so it's bringing additional things into the prohibition. That's generally what is meant by the word including. So that would be, I think that would be a policy choice for this panel if you guys were to determine that that was broader than necessary to achieve the goal. But usually it means inclusive rather than exclusive. Does that answer your question, Representative Hayden?
Thank you.
Mr. Kahneman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the general tenor of the bill, I guess I was wondering why on line 12 it's not gender neutral.
There are some amendments coming, I understand. I'm not sure whether they relate to any of these questions or not.
The one that I'm aware of does not.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, I have not seen any amendments. That might be a question better asked of people who understand conversion therapy a little bit better than I do. Okay. Again, my knowledge is grounded in the legality of how the bill is put together, not an expert in conversion therapy. I will say this. There was a lot of discussion about how to put together this definition. And if you look at the bill, we kind of break from our traditional way of writing definitions, because usually what we say is something means something, and then if we want to take something out of the definition, we say it does not include it. Yeah. And here we've created a clear break between this definition means this and it does not mean this. If you look at line 13, efforts to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity does not mean. And that's because there's supposed to be a clear delineation between these two acts, one in which you're actually trying to change gender identity or sexual orientation, and the other in which you're providing the counseling that's described in subsection 2A, B, I, and subsection 2B, 2A, B, I. So in those particular descriptions, there's supposed to be a clear break from the other language that's described where somebody's actually attempting to change. That was the intent of the drafting.
Representative Nose?
Mr. Chair, it's more of a comment than a question, but I think I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm not an attorney or an expert on this, but I think the reason to include the words same gender in line 12 is probably because people who are attracted to the opposite gender are not being subjected to this kind of therapy. Right, and so to be clear about what the therapy is and what we're targeting is, it's people who would provide a service targeting folks to say no, it's deviant or wrong to be attracted to someone of the same gender. That's my guess, though.
Okay, let's move on. Thank you very much for coming. We'll have a work session. We may have you back for some more legal comments. Would you call the next?
Okay. We have
panel, please. Is the next panel going to be a panel that opposes the bill?
After this one individual, there would be. There's Trevor Chandler, and then we go into two other individuals.
All right. Let's have Trevor Chandler, and then we'll have two individuals who signed up in opposition to the bill. Please introduce yourself.
Yes. Hi, my name is Trevor Chandler. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to represent the Human Rights Campaign and our thousands of members across the state. Chairperson Greenlich and members of the House Committee, House Healthcare Committee, the Human Rights Campaign, also known as HRC, on behalf of our thousands of members in Oregon, thanks you for this hearing on HB 2307, a vital measure that will protect young people from dangerous and discredited practices that falsely claim to change one's sexual orientation or gender identity or expression. The Human Rights Campaign is America's largest civil rights organization for working to achieve lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equality. And by inspiring and engaging all Americans, HRC strives to end discrimination against LGBT citizens and realize a nation that achieves fundamental fairness and equality for all. As an advocate for LGBT young people, HRC believes that no young person should be coerced or subjected to dangerous practices that lack legitimate medical purpose, such as conversion therapy. Conversion therapy, sometimes referred to as sexual orientation change efforts, are practices sometimes performed by licensed medical health providers which seek to change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity or expression. These practices are based on the false idea that being LGBT is a mental illness that needs to be cured, an idea which has been rejected by every major medical health group for decades. Conversion therapy does not include therapies that provide acceptance, support, or understanding of LGBT identities, that facilitate coping, social support, or identity exploration, or that address unlawful conduct or unsafe sexual practices. This legislation enacts professional standards for state-licensed mental health providers to clarify that sexual orientation change efforts that are not acceptable or responsible professional practice when applied to young people under the age of 18. There is absolutely no credible evidence that conversion therapy can change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity, and it is abundantly clear that conversion therapy poses devastating health risks for LGBT young people. These dangerous practices can lead to depression, decreased self-esteem, substance abuse, homelessness, and even suicidal behavior, and for this reason, the nation's leading mental health organizations have roundly decried them. Unfortunately, due to discrimination against LGBT people and the fact that the professional rules have not kept up with this widespread understanding, some mental health licensed mental health professionals continue to engage in conversion therapy. Research shows that young people experience conversion therapy as a form of family rejection, and LGBT youth who experience family rejection face increased health risks. In one study, such youth were 8.4 times more likely to report having attempted suicide, 5.9 times more likely to report high levels of depression, and 3.4 times more likely to use illegal drugs compared with peers who had not experienced such rejection. On the other hand, family acceptance has been shown to be an important protective factor that can help to prevent suicide behavior and mental health issues. Providers who engage in conversion therapy under the veneer of a state license can mislead families about the risks involved, leading to negative psychological outcomes and irreparable damage to family cohesiveness. This legislation is needed to protect families from these damaging practices. So finally, we urge you to pass the proposed amendment to the Youth Mental Health Protection Act, which would replace the term sexual orientation and gender identity change efforts with the term conversion therapy. Although many terms are used to describe the damaging practices this bill seeks to prohibit, the term conversion therapy is the most recognized and best understood by the general public. This change of language also brings this bill in line with language of similar bills in other states. We believe this amendment will make this restricted practices very clear and prevent any confusion about the reach and limitations of the bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to submit testimony in favor of this critical bill to protect LGBT youth, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Quick question. Chair Greenlick. So I have one quick question on age of consent here. Chair Greenlick pointed out that it doesn't ban the practice. It just bans it for minors, 18 or 17 and under. So my question, in the medical community, most age of consent is considered above 14 or 15, 16, 17, including those for most of the issues that we're talking about as far as reproductive systems. Why was this one picked to kind of not line up with that, and it's lined up at 18 rather than at 15?
I'll leave that to the other medical professionals that are testifying today, but I can say with the high suicide rates and risk rates that are described in these studies, they are for folks who are 18 and under, which shows a significant risk in developing minds. But for the specific reasoning, I'll leave it to the medical professionals.
Yes, sir.
Considering that there's consensus on this being a poor medical practice, wouldn't a provider who's doing this type of counseling be at risk of medical liability?
I'll leave that to the medical folks as well. But as long as this is legal and not banned, then there is no recourse. And in several cases, people don't necessarily know that they're going into a place that...
But if it's clearly against the standards of their profession, why would you say there's no recourse?
Because
from a legal.
What was that?
Legal or professional board jurisdiction.
Because right now this practice is not banned at all. And so a person doesn't necessarily need to advertise the fact that they are a conversion therapist. This could simply be beliefs they hold, and a family may not even know that they're going to see such a therapist.
But they'd still be at risk of legal repercussions if it was...
Extent to which it's consumer fraud, I suppose.
Yeah. Just like any medical professional, if they're doing a treatment that's out of the standard of care, they're going to be at legal risk.
I'll leave that to the legal counsel to get more into that aspect.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we have the next panel, please?
Teresa Hans?
Harkey.
Harkey? Sorry. Couldn't tell if it was a... Yeah, I'm sorry. And Greg Hamilton.
How many more witnesses do I have?
Okay.
Hi, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Harkey, and I am the lobbyist for the Oregon Family Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We come here today with concerns about House Bill 2307. Some of these concerns have already been mentioned today, so I apologize for any of your petition. I will try to be brief. As we understand it, the bill seeks to prevent the forced counseling of minors regarding conversion and sexuality and gender. Oregon Family Council is committed to protecting religious freedoms, and while we understand the purpose behind this bill, we are concerned that the written language is too broad and may have unintended consequences for religious liberties. So I come before you today with questions and concerns I feel need to be addressed before this bill can move forward, and I ask you to consider these concerns and make the necessary changes to the bill. Firstly, keeping in mind that Oregon minors 15 and older can legally make their own medical decisions, such as life-changing decisions such as receiving an abortion, the first question we feel needs to be addressed is whether or not this bill prevents a minor from seeking therapy of their own accord. Would a counselor or licensed professional face penalties for treating someone who seeks out their help for unwanted feelings? The second would be, under the current broad language of the bill, it seems that a parent who is a licensed counselor or professional could face sanctions for talking with their own children at home about sexuality and gender identity topics. Furthermore, the ambiguous language of the bill seems to restrict any and all work done by a licensed professional in the context of sexuality or gender identity, including volunteering at a church, a private school, a nonprofit, or a youth group. An organization that works with churches, we are concerned that how this bill would affect a licensed counselor who's doing work under the ministry of the church. I know this was already brought up. Would a licensed professional, whether they maintain a private practice or not, be censured under this bill for using that license training while working or volunteering as part of a church ministry? And I guess that would also include retired. Due to the broad language of the bill, could a licensed professional who simply says they disagree with any sexual orientation or gender identity be seen as attempting to change behaviors or expressions? This refers to the language in the bill as you were discussing earlier. Additionally, would that prohibit a licensed professional, say somebody who is a lay minister at their church, from at a church service simply reading a religious text that disagrees with sexual orientation or gender identity, such as Romans 1, in front of minors? In relation to that issue, how would this bill affect church counseling programs and ministries in general? Would it restrict them from speaking to youth within their church ministries to these topics? And how would this affect a licensed school counselor at a Christian school? We're also wondering how this would affect a 501c3 nonprofit counseling program. Would a licensed professional face sanctions for working with a nonprofit in a counseling program or church or private school that has views that are opposed this? And we wonder if there are freedoms or protections for faith-based counseling and psychology programs for religious universities such as George Fox. So that's a lot of questions I laid before you. So I have submitted written testimony that you will be receiving, as well as a brief from Alliance Defending Freedom with their First Amendment concerns. They were unable to be here today, but you should have that. I strongly urge you to consider these and review these questions and concerns, and hopefully introduce an amendment that would address some of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and distinguished committee members. My name is Greg Hamilton. I'm president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. We champion the constitutional separation of church and state, but also the free exercise of religion. And we defend religious discrimination victims in the workplace under Title VII law. I just come to say, basically, to concur with the Oregon Family Council's questions and concerns. It's of concern to us what or how broad this bill is and how sweeping it is in terms of how it could unintendedly affect churches. Even though I've heard that it will not affect churches, I see no evidence of that in the bill itself. And perhaps you could help us with that.
I don't think you heard that. I think the answer was if a licensed person is practicing,
yes,
they're covered by the bill, even in the church context.
That was helpful to hear, yes.
Okay, thank you very
much.
Thank you.
We have about 8 more folks, and we have about 15 minutes, so that leaves about 2 minutes a person. Could you call the next 3, please?
Caleb Hayes and David Sant, S-A-N-T.
Let's call 3.
Okay. Cecile Prescott? 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 Oh, okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon chapter. We are the largest and most well-recognized association for social workers in the world, representing 1,700 members right here in Oregon. Our legislative committee has taken a look at this legislation and unanimously voted to support it, if for no other reason that we believe it will save the lives of LGBTQ youth. With that, I'll turn it over to David Sant. He's our legislative committee chair and a master's level clinical social worker practicing right here in Oregon.
Hi, I'm David Sant, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is David Sant, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker here in Oregon. And I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers Oregon chapter in support of HB 2307. I'm also speaking to you today as a gay man who grew up in a religious community and can speak of the dangers of this type of practice. To call it conversion therapy is a misnomer, since it is neither a therapeutic process, nor does it succeed in changing the individual's orientation from anything other than straight to straight. All mainstream, reputable, scientifically based organizations, including that which I represent, have issued policy statements telling of the dangers that are complete within this type of ideology. Indeed, the assumption that one can change his or her orientation or identity ultimately increases guilt, shame, and a profound sense of depression, because no matter how hard you try, how much therapy you go to, how many tear-filled prayers at night, you will continue to be as you were the very next day. The state of Oregon must continue in its pursuit of justice for all historically persecuted groups, including gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered folks, and join California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. in passing this type of legislation. Too many young people have been lost to drugs, suicide, and depression because of the belief systems that conversion therapy represents, that we are sick, that we are less than. We must finish the healing process. NASW calls on you to pass HB 2307. Thank you. Do you have any other questions?
Chair?
Yes.
Could I just ask the quick question?
Go for it.
Are you familiar with what the standards are with regards to this for licensing by LCSW here in Oregon?
I can tell you that for social workers,
yes.
We stay in line with current practices as far as, what science tells us is to be true. And science tells us that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people are normal and should be treated as such. And for those who are practicing to try to change that, they probably should have good malpractice insurance. That's all I can say about that.
Okay, thank you. I think it's probably stronger than that. But
yeah.
Without knowledge, we can't say that. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Cecil Prescott. You have my submitted testimony, so I'll just highlight a couple of things. To those who express worry that this bill is an infringement on religious liberty, I do not think so. The bill does not restrict protected First Amendment speech. It prohibits discredited treatments by state-licensed medical health care professional. It does not apply to clergy or to individuals who provide religious instructions. It also does not prevent anyone from publishing, discussing, or advocating any viewpoint or beliefs regarding sexual orientation or anything else. As a person of faith, I believe we must surround our young people with support, affirmation, positivity, and encouragement. I believe in building communities of love that foster an environment in which young people can flourish and contribute to their school, their place of worship, and to the community broadly. We have an opportunity to do for this state just that by passing a policy that say no to therapy aimed at changing or suppressing who people are. I might also add that all major religious groups that I know of, Christian and Jewish, have stated that sexual orientation is something given at birth, and whether or not you believe LGBT people should marry or not, all major religious groups believe that sexual orientation is a given, that it cannot be changed. Religious organization may support LGBT ministers or priests or marriage, or they may not. But most religious organizations, conservative, liberal, or those in between, believe that sexual orientation and gender identity is something that cannot be changed. This bill will prohibit dangerous practices. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys. Call the next panel, please.
Paul Southwick, Nico Quintana, Norman Birthmark.
And after that, there are two more.
Correct, that last two.
Who are the last two?
The last two is Buster Ross and Greg Mayland, or Moreland.
Let's go.
Dear Chair Greenlick and the committee, my name is Paul Southwick, and I'm here to testify today to ask you to support House Bill 2307. I have deep roots in Oregon, having grown up in Salem, Colton, and Molina. I went to college out in Newburgh, and now I live in North Portland. I'm here today to share my experience with conversion therapy. One night, while a student, I woke up suddenly feeling frightened. A tingling sensation began overtaking my body, first in my hands, my arms, and my feet and legs. I couldn't breathe or speak. I felt like I was dying. After I was rushed from campus to the hospital in an ambulance, a doctor told me I had experienced a panic attack. I was 20 years old. Shortly after this distressing experience, I entered conversion therapy for the first time. I entered conversion therapy because my panic attack was caused by the extreme anxiety that I had relating to my same-sex attractions. I needed help, so I turned to professionals who I trusted to help me. My parents trusted them too. I first experienced conversion therapy at an on-campus counseling center. My therapist was a graduate student who was supervised by a licensed professional. We spoke about anxiety, depression, and same-sex attractions. Unfortunately, he tried to help me overcome my homosexual orientation, and when I asked for his advice on how to do this, he suggested I watch heterosexual pornography in the hopes of arousing sexual desire for women. His advice only increased my confusion, anxiety, and depression. My second experience with conversion therapy was through a licensed professional in private practice in Gresham, Oregon. We only had a few sessions, but we ended our professional relationship after he told me he was not sure I could be cured, but he did not follow up that statement by saying I didn't need a cure. He didn't offer me that assurance. So I left his care feeling angry and defeated. My final involvement with conversion therapy was through the Portland Fellowship, an ex-gay program in Southeast Portland I attended for 2 years. Several members of the staff taught us about the roots of male homosexuality, focusing on things like childhood sexual abuse and our relationships with our parents. These themes were also discussed in my sessions with licensed therapists. The goal of the program was to graduate in 2 years with a certificate saying that you are now straight. I declined to attend the graduation ceremony because my anxiety had only worsened and my sexual attractions had not diminished. It took me several years before I could come out as a gay man. It took me several more to lose the shame. When you're in conversion therapy, you're taught that you have a sickness and that you need a cure. When that cure never comes, you're left even more hopeless than when you started. It's taken me a long time to forgive the people who tried to help me because I know they acted out of compassion. My parents wanted to see me better and healthy. I've forgiven, but I've not forgotten the pain And I don't want any young people to experience that same kind of pain. So I urge you to vote in support of House Bill 2307. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Nico Quintana, and I'm the Policy Director for Basic Rights Oregon. I want to extend my deep support for House Bill 2307, the Youth Mental Health Protection Act. I support this bill because it will have life-saving impacts on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth in Oregon. This bill will protect LGBT youth from harmful practices of conversion therapy, which aim to change sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression of LGBT youth. These harmful practices use rejection, shame, and psychological abuse to force young people to try and change who they are. These practices are known to be extremely dangerous and can lead to depression, decreased self-esteem, substance use, and even suicide. Despite the progress we've made, devastating rates of violence and discrimination still exist in Oregon, particularly for transgender youth and LGBT youth of color, leading to higher rates of health disparities and early mortality and morbidity. 83% of transgender Oregonians experience harassment or discrimination on the job. 23% have experienced homelessness, and 40% have reported a history of suicide attempts. Additionally, LGBT people of color experience higher rates of poverty, harassment, discrimination, and negative life outcomes, health outcomes across the board. In 2014 alone, I lost 4 transgender friends and colleagues, 1 to suicide, 1 to murder due to a hate crime, and 2 died of health disparities, health issues. The youngest was 22 years of age. We need only look to the nation's headlines to be reminded of how conversion therapy is claiming the lives of our community members and our young people. On December 28, 2014, Leila Alcorn, a 17-year-old transgender girl from Ohio, took her own life after being subjected to conversion therapy. In her notes to her friends, she spoke to her hope that one day transgender people aren't treated the way that she was, that they're treated like humans with valid feelings and human rights. It grieves me that youth like Leila are still being subjected to the discredited and harmful practices of conversion therapy. Oregon is a leader on LGBT issues, and we are asking you, our state leaders, to once again demonstrate that the lives of LGBT Oregonians are important. I urge you to support HB 2307 and ban conversion therapy for minors in Oregon by licensed providers, and consider the consequences that not acting will have on the lives of thousands LGBT youth in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for having us. My name is Norman Birthmark. I was born and raised in Portland, where I still reside. I strongly support House Bill 2307, the Youth Mental Health Protection Act. In 1995, I shared my sexuality to a student group during my freshman year at Oregon State University. Like many LGBT teens, coming out was a very traumatic experience for me. I felt completely vulnerable, having revealed my deepest, darkest secret at a time when there was no out gay people in my classes. Eventually, the campus group at OSU referred me to the Portland Fellowship, an ex-gay Christian ministry. I went through a 2-year program called Taking Back Ground, which included 101 and group counseling about how to overcome homosexuality through various techniques, including conversion reparative therapy. I also regularly saw a licensed professional therapist who was on the Portland Fellowship's board. Although I was 19 years old and technically an adult, I never had counseling before and never considered questioning or challenging the expertise of the people who counseled me. I trusted them. However, the more I committed myself to the program and the work of this therapist, the more I eventually realized the counseling was far more harmful than helpful. Instead of empowering or affirming me, I felt more guilt and shame about my attractions. I was counseled to question the supposed root causes of my natural attractions. Before the counseling, I was proud of the way I was raised. However, the counseling convinced me that my attractions were a sign that I came from a broken home. Before the counseling, I felt like a relatively normal guy. However, the counseling convinced me that my sexuality was a sign that I actually lacked masculinity and needed to find a male role model. And before the counseling, I felt relatively confident. However, the counseling convinced me that my sexuality was a sign that I was socially and psychologically stunted and sexually broken. After 2 years with this therapist, I completely lost my self-confidence and eventually dropped out of school. It took me several years to rebuild my identity and self-confidence, far longer than the time I spent in the ex-gay program. Thankfully, I met others who left the program and found the support of others who experienced these harmful practices. Today, I'm happily partnered and have been together for 9 years now. The reason I feel this bill is so important to pass is that I know personally that conversion therapy can cause great harm. No LGBT teen should be told by a professional therapist to be ashamed of their natural, normal, and healthy attractions. Being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered is not a disorder that needs treatment. The state should protect LGBT teens from this harmful, unproven, and unneeded supposed therapy. I urge this committee to vote in support of HB 307. No one should have to go through what I went through. Thank you.
Thank you all for your very brave testimony. It's very moving for us to hear your stories. Thank you. Did you call the last two folks? We're sort of over time already, but I want to make sure everybody gets heard.
Buster Ross and Greg Moreland.
Good afternoon. My name is Buster Ross, Chair Greenlick, and members of the House Committee on Healthcare. I'm the National LGBTQ Program Director for the largest nonprofit addiction treatment organization in the country, and I'm really tired. I work with people day in and day out who've gone through conversion therapy. I'm cleaning up the other side of it. I'm a professional counselor in Oregon. I'm a certified sexuality counselor, and I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. Quoting David Kaplan, the chief professional officer of the American Counseling Association, efforts to change sexual orientation from homosexuality to heterosexuality do not work. They have the potential to do great harm to a child and are aimed at treating a mental health problem that does not exist. We've heard this today. My own research, together with many other studies, has clearly demonstrated the harms caused by these sort of change efforts. Every major mental health organization stands against conversion therapy. I live in Oregon. I care about the youth of Oregon. We never think it's going to be our child or our neighbor's child. We never hear the stories because they commit suicide. We don't hear what it's about. And I hear the stories of those who survive those suicide attempts. So in my 4 years specializing in this work, in the research published in the Journal of Gay and Lesbian Social Services, I have firsthand seen the devastating effects of these kinds of change therapies, and it's beyond on behalf of Oregonians, the next generation of young people. I implore you today, they're really harmful practices. We're almost through this. You can be a part of this being done. You can save lives by doing this work with this bill. I really believe that you can. And not doing this, I can't speak for that, but I can speak for the good that will come of doing this, and it far outweighs any potential opportunities to fine-tune this bill. So, thank you for hearing me.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and committee, thank you for hearing me. I'm Greg Moreland. Some of you know me in different roles. I'm the vice chair of the LGBT caucus for the Democratic Party of Oregon. I'm going to start off with my own personal story. From a very young age, growing up here in Oregon, I knew I was different. I knew that I thought differently, saw things differently, and felt things differently from everyone else. I also realized that I was also attracted to guys more than girls. In my child's mind, I put these things together and thought that all of my differences were due to being gay. And I so much wanted to be like everyone else. When I was in middle school, I began hearing about programs and counselors who vowed that they can make someone like me straight. I researched some of these programs and read books by licensed psychologists that promised to fix me. A couple of years out of college, I finally connected with a conversion therapy group in Dallas, Texas, where my job had located me. I actively tried to make it work for me, but after countless sessions of heart-wrenching effort over a year, I realized that it was not going to happen, and I was a failure. For the next several years, I dove into my career, pretty much completely neglecting anything else in my life. I did try a couple of relationships with guys, but they failed. I could not fully live since I had had so many things that were unresolved. I had done nothing to fix myself. It wasn't until more than 15 years later, when I turned 40 years old, that I connected with a new group of ex-gay survivors at BeyondXGay.com, a group that's devoted to affirming people as they really are and supporting individuals who have been scarred by conversion efforts. I drove down to their first conference in Irvine, California, not knowing what to expect. I enjoyed the conference, but didn't feel moved by any of it. It wasn't until I drove back to Oregon after the conference, when I was flooded with emotions of what had happened, where I was with my life, and how I had shut off a large part of who I was. So in 2006, I slowly started living. Since that time, I have been further finding out who I really am, and finally, as recently as last year, discovered that many of the differences I was trying to fix all those years ago are much more due to living with Asperger's syndrome on the autism spectrum. Through my life and from the stories I've heard from the ex-gay survivor network, I directly see the harm that is caused with conversion therapy. While it's unrealistic to ask for a complete ban of all forms of conversion therapy, it is very important to support this bill and put an end to the practice of conversion therapy by licensed professionals for minors. When California passed the ban in 2012, the LGBT caucus of the Democratic Party of Oregon passed a resolution to do the same in Oregon. The full DPO State Center Committee followed with a vote in support of the resolution. We have been working with our coalition partners ever since. This is not just important to me, but is also important to our LGBT youth. Protecting our children from dangerous practices such as this and the harm it causes, that's not just something that's important to Democrats in Oregon, that's something important to all Oregonians. So I ask for your support of House Bill 2307, and thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2307 and adjourn, and thank you all for coming and being patient with us as we got through all of it. Thank you all for coming.